The San Francisco Experience Podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy. Independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 25, Episode 18, Advanced Trauma Life Support on the Front Lines in Ukraine, talking with Dr. Michael Baker. Our guest today is Dr. Michael Baker, a retired surgeon who teaches advanced trauma life support to civilian and military providers, as well as Stop the Bleed. He's completed 3 tours in Ukraine and will soon embark on his 4th deployment. Hello, Michael, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mr. Herlihy. I appreciate the invitation.
My pleasure. Michael, you've had a 40-year career in general surgery with a parallel career in the military, and you retired with the rank of Rear Admiral. You've gone on to teach political science and military affairs for the Osher Lifelong Learning Program at UC Berkeley, Dominican University, and Cal State University East Bay. You also serve as a trustee for the Commonwealth Club of California. And then, in late 2022, when many retirees are heading to the golf course, you undertook several deployments to Ukraine to teach advanced trauma life support. And you'll soon be heading back to Ukraine for your 4th deployment. Tell us about your remarkable career as a surgeon and your work in Ukraine.
Thank you for that question. It's a very interesting route has brought me to having these 3 careers. I became a surgeon because of a book that I read when I was probably 7 or 8 years old called The Century of a Surgeon. And I immediately said, that's exactly what I want to do for a career. And I headed that direction through college and into medical school. But while I was in college and in medical school, the Vietnam War was going full force. Mm-hmm. And by the time the Tet Offensive rolled around, you're roughly my age, you remember those days.
Of course.
Most of us were not very much in favor of the war. We didn't even understand why we were fighting in Vietnam. So I did everything I could do to make sure I didn't get drafted. However, I had done enough international travel between college and medical school, and then after medical school and before my surgery training, where I had gaps, that came home very appreciative of this country and the opportunities we have. So I looked around for an opportunity to do a payback, and I looked at several different options and settled on the Navy, where I had read that they were very short of general surgeons, and they offered me a reserve commission, and I thought I would do it for 2 or 3 years. That was the plan. That was at least the original plan. And I got hooked by the interesting events that I got to participate in and the wonderful people I got to work with who were my shipmates. And it was just went on for I spent a total of 30 years in uniform, part-time as a reserve officer. But sometimes I was gone 12 weeks a year. You know, I'd go a week a month rather than a weekend a month as a normal reservist. Once you get to be very senior, you're participating in a lot of exercises and a lot of other events. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when all that was over and I finally retired from both, I was in an interesting place in terms of a guy who had always worked overtime, doing 2 jobs all the time. And, you know, what do I do with these skills? And I used to chuckle because for a while, my youngest daughter would introduce me to people as being unemployed. And, you know, and I don't play golf. So, 2 things happened, and one of which was that Ollie reached out to me to start teaching things in Berkeley,
yes,
basically asking me to teach about military stuff, stating that, what do you want me to teach? And they said, well, nobody here knows anything about the military, so anything about that would be great. So that's kind of where I got my 3rd career as a teacher, and actually it's now expanded to a couple more programs and a couple more universities. So if I'm local, I try to teach in person, and if it's someplace like Cal State Channel Islands down near Santa Barbara, I teach on Zoom. And, you know, I've really enjoyed it. I do like 6-week courses. And I also get a lot of interesting questions and meet interesting people both online and in person. You know, many of whom here have become my friends, get together and talk about all the stuff that's interesting going on in the world. So all those things kind of teed me up for this next event, which is heading off to Ukraine to teach advanced trauma life support. We call it ATLS for short. Mm-hmm. I've been an instructor since 1985. It was clearly John Muir Hospital where I did most of my surgery as a trauma center. We all had to be able to pass that course, and I chose to teach it. So I taught it both to civilians and military providers. This last summer, I was in South Korea teaching it at a U.S. military base there. So I've been teaching this subject for years, and now I'm also a course director. After a while, they give you more responsibility. This time, as when the ATLS opportunity came up to go to Ukraine, I said, well, that's something I'm happy to teach. I'm happy to work on the courses. And I just felt like it was so important to get involved in the current events that, and also to show my daughter that I was no longer unemployed.
Michael, tell me, what does the course consist of? Because it would seem to me, of course, I'm not a medical professional, far from it, but tell me what the course covers and who it's targeted towards.
Right. Well, we teach it primarily to physicians, but also to other providers such as dentists and physician's assistants, you know, particularly in the military, they might wind up handling trauma. Mm-hmm. So we teach it to a lot of physicians, and it's a course that's to give them a common language on how to deal with the topic of trauma and to give them an algorithm so that they know what to do in the first critical minutes when they're confronted with an injured patient. Mm-hmm. And it sounds simplistic, but we even sort of use an ABC system where we try to get everybody to memorize the fact that the first thing you look at is the airway, that's A. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing you look at is B, breathing, checking the chest and all for expansion, and C is circulation, the heart. So we give them an algorithm that they can follow, and it's done in good teaching tools. American College of Surgeons, which is the sponsor of this, is very good at putting together the fact that first you do a didactic lecture, then you do a skill station with mannequins or some way that you can demonstrate it, and then you have your students demonstrate it back to you. So that if you want them to learn a procedure or to do a task, you make them show you that they can now do it. And so translating that into the Ukrainian language and into the Ukrainian medical care system was very interesting. Mm-hmm. Everybody was very receptive, mm-hmm. and they wanted to learn everything we could teach them. A lot of times they would corral us afterwards, you know, to go have coffee, to ask us more questions about more things about, you know, some of the other things that we do in our trauma. But basically this is to teach people what to do during that first contact with a casualty to save their life.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Ukrainian, of course. You mentioned that you don't speak the language. Did you have interpreters or did you conduct the instruction in English?
So we had interpreters who were absolutely fantastic, and they were crucial to the task because they went over the slides every night to make sure that Google Translate got it right, mm-hmm. didn't make some inappropriate statement during that, which we found a few of. Yeah. And, you know, then they stood literally right by my shoulder, whether I was giving a didactic lecture or I was doing a skill station, I always had an interpreter right there by my shoulder. So we had really excellent interpreters. They were very crucial to what we were working on. They made sure that everybody really understood what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And they were very, very talented. In fact, one of my interpreters was so good, I think he could have done all the lectures without me. He really picked it up so fast. Mm-hmm. That, you know, not only could he translate it, but he could also enumerate the details very well so that people got the nuances of what we were trying to explain.
Mm-hmm. The people who were taking this course in Ukraine, doctors, nurses, that was pretty much your audience?
Yeah, mostly, almost all physicians. Mm-hmm. Occasionally we'd have a dentist or a trauma nurse from the military. That's pretty much it. Almost all doctors.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we think of trauma centers here in the United States, of course, you mentioned John Muir Hospital Medical Center over there in Walnut Creek. That's a regional trauma center. Here in San Francisco, we have San Francisco General. So in the greater Bay Area, we have a number of significant trauma centers. How is Ukraine set up in terms of their, in normal times, in terms of their trauma center coverage in a big city like Kyiv, for instance, or Odessa?
Okay. To the extent that I understand all their hospitals and every area is a little different, the big differences are that they don't so much have surgeons who specialize in trauma care, which is a specialty that we have much more robustly in the U.S. Mm-hmm. They bring a casualty to the hospital, and then they call the specialist down who's appropriate for that injury. So what we're trying to get them to do is to think globally, is that this person is multiply injured, might need more than one specialist, but you should have somebody in there who's the quarterback and who coordinates everything and takes care of it. The other thing that's a huge difference with respect to the fact that this war is on is where I live in the Bay Area. As you well know, you know, you hear helicopters going overhead all the time, lifting casualties up off the freeway or bringing them down from the highway in the mountains or somewhere, get them to the trauma center very quickly for care. On the battlefield, some of the casualties we found out were sitting for 6, 8, 12, 24 hours on the battlefield till they could be evacuated. Mm-hmm. So then we had to adjust a little bit of the teaching for a system that didn't have helicopter evacuation, for a system where you were under fire and you might not be able to bring somebody out for 24 hours. And that made us change some of the teaching and focus it a little bit more into their environment, which is much more difficult than ours in terms of getting casualties to the hospital for care.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the war in Ukraine has been going on for over 2 years now, and the front lines have ebbed and flowed, you know, to the east and to the south and so on and so forth. How far from the front lines would an average hospital be in the Ukraine, or you can't really estimate that?
I was going to say it's it just depends where you are. You know, obviously some of those cities that got bombarded were right in the middle of it, took a tremendous beating. But there's cities that are further back, you know, like Kherson or Kharkiv or Dnipro, some of these other cities, Zaporizhia. You know, they're pretty close. They're within, I would say, missile range, perhaps. I'm not sure if they're within artillery range. I'd have to look at the map today. But, you know, there's definitely some risk. Although, as you well know, the missiles can fly anywhere into Ukraine from Russia. And they're quite adept at bombing schools and hospitals and other civilian targets, as we see every day, which is very unfortunate.
We've heard that that hospitals in particular, maternity hospitals, but hospitals in particular, have been targeted. Was that your experience? And did you find that even in the safer areas, that some of the hospitals where you worked had suffered collateral damage or not?
I didn't have any communication with anybody who told me about that personally, but I did know that in some of the areas where we were, some of the hospitals had taken hits. And of course, you know, we all saw early in the conflict, incredible photo of the pregnant lady being carried out of the hospital in Mariupol, which was a maternity hospital getting bombarded. So, you know, do I think it's accidental? You know, when you hit most of the missiles and things that people use today, a lot of this stuff is smart ordnance, and it can hit a target that you put it on. And to hit schools and hospitals and apartment buildings is, you know, a little bit beyond the pale. And, you know, in my mind, it's a bit of a war crime.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, when you were, for the three deployments that you've had in Ukraine, how were they organized? Did this draw on your U.S. Navy experience, or was there some independent NGO that arranged for U.S. surgeons to go to Ukraine?
Well, there's actually two organizations that did the trips and the courses for us. I was initially contacted by the International Medical Corps that reached out to me. And that's somewhat of a funny story, because about a week before they reached out to me, one of my shipmates from the Navy days was giving a lecture at the Commonwealth Club. And he had been serving in Ukraine with the International Legion as an intelligence officer. And of course, we went out afterwards and talked for several hours about the war and about what was going on in the world. And a week later, International Medical Corps reaches out to me and says, can you go teach this casualty care course in Ukraine? So I don't think the two events are necessarily unrelated, although he tries to deny it. That's a whole other story. But the, you know, they set it up, and they do the logistics and the travel. And then the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative does the background checks and makes sure that we really are certified instructors, or in my case, a course director. And they handle some of that kind of, so it's actually these two organizations together, both of which are charitable, non-governmental organizations, or as we call them, NGOs. And so they arrange the trip. And I think, you know, they provide all the supplies, all the teaching materials, all the slides, the translation, they hire the interpreters. It's a pretty big production. So this will be I was in the very first wave of instructors that went when we went to Kyiv back in August 2022. And this is the 20th wave of instruction. Mm. Each wave does 4 ATLS courses, which means probably 120 docs, somewhere in that range, depending on how many can make it. You know, they're also very busy, so not everybody can make it. There are other courses that go along with us at the same time that do their own thing, having to do with related subjects, some of which are for nursing staff, some of which are for other kinds of problems to help everybody. But yeah, Harvard Humanitarian Initiative, International Medical Corps, they set it all up. And it's, like I said, between the interpreters and the slides and the mannequins and the supplies and everything you need, it's a big thing. It takes a lot of coordination, which is why they're probably there working this out together.
Are any other countries who are helping Ukraine in this this struggle against Russia, are there any other countries apart from the United States that are offering this kind of trauma training on the ground, or is the United States the only one at this point?
You know, there's a lot of different groups offering a lot of different opportunities. I don't specifically know about trauma from other countries, but what I can tell you is that a couple of my instructors were instructors from other countries who had become ATLS instructors certified by the U.S. So I had a Dutch instructor who was an absolutely fabulous guy who currently is in Gaza. Mm-hmm. He spends a lot of his time, you know, going over doing humanitarian missions. Yeah, so there's a lot of, you know, there's also some, not only organizations, but, you know, there's some freelancers. I actually know a friend from my prior naval service who got a bunch of ultrasound machines and then went around Ukraine to teach the doctors and staff at the various hospitals near the front how to use an ultrasound machine in trauma. And as far as I know, he funded himself and went and did it on his own and, you know, has gone back several times again to continue to teach. So, you know, there's NGOs doing it. There's probably aid from governmental organizations, and there's freelancers, which is pretty amazing to see people who say, you know, I can go to this city and I can teach them how to do ultrasound. I'll take them a truckload of machines and I'll teach them how to use them, which is amazing. So there's a lot of brave people who are willing to provide the service that they think that the Ukrainians need to promote their democracy.
As you were teaching these classes throughout Ukraine, what was your impression of the level of medical training of the Ukrainian professionals that you were working with? Was this ATLS course, was this something completely new for them? Or obviously they, in their training, did they have, they had exposure to modern sophisticated trauma techniques? Give us a sense of how much, what their level of trauma training was before you got there and where they stood at the end of the course.
So the education system for doctors in Ukraine is a little different than ours. Some of the training is a bit shorter than ours so that they don't necessarily have as many years. For me, in training for a general surgery, was 5 years. Mm-hmm. I believe it's a year or two shorter in Ukraine. And whatever focus you get on trauma depends on the hospital you're at, what they see, and you know, how they do their stuff different. So for them to do the advanced trauma life support, ATLS was for them a real eye-opener to see how we did it in a different way, how we organized our personnel and our teams, and, you know, tried to concentrate on the most important thing first, which is always very crucial in the trauma care. So they very much liked it. They are not only enamored of the course in terms of the skill sets that we provided, but what we've done as part of nation building is each time we taught courses, we tried to find outstanding students who were potential instructors. And then in the next courses, we would let them instruct while we mentored them. And part of my role on this last and 20th deployment is those student instructors are going to do the whole show, and I am going to certify them for the American College of Surgeons if they are up to our level in terms of teaching, which I'm sure they will be. They were very good. They picked it up very fast, and the guys that wanted to teach, you know, are really very thoughtful and intelligent guys who understand how to convey the stuff and how to teach the material. And so we're going to actually certify them that they will be instructors for the American College of Surgeons who can go anywhere, anytime and teach the information, which means that the Ukrainian medical people can now run their own courses. They simply need to tell the American College of Surgeons, we would like to do this course in this place on such and such a day, and here's our list of certified instructors. Mm-hmm. And they're good to go. So we have not only taught them how to do it, we've now enabled them to do it for themselves.
Mm-hmm, which is always the best way. Now tell me, of course, we've had this war has dragged on for 2 years. Who knows how much longer it's going to last? But as with any war, it will eventually come to an end, and there will be opportunities for reconstruction and for rebuilding infrastructure. And of course, new hospitals and damaged hospitals will have to be repaired. Any sense of, you know, looking further down the road, a year or two, when we begin, when Ukraine, I should say, begins the reconstruction process, any sense of being able to integrate these new trauma techniques into their medical training and also their actual medical provisions in their existing hospitals and hospitals that will be new hospitals that will be built to replace the damaged ones?
I think that's an incredibly great question, because they're obviously going to need to fix some of the damaged places. Mm-hmm. They're going to build some new places. They're, I'm sure some of the education is going to change to align a little bit more with other countries. I think part of that will be driven by them getting into the economic union. You know, the European Union does a lot of things cross borders that make it much easier for both knowledge and equipment to flow across borders. So that mm-hmm. will be extremely helpful if they're in the EU. And then their healthcare system, compared to most of us in the West, and by that I mean America and the European countries, they don't have quite as much money. So their salaries for guys are quite a bit lower. That's why the training is a little bit shorter. Mm-hmm. But they're going to need some money pumped into the healthcare system to improve it, so that I actually met some doctors who had second jobs after they finished their medical shift. They would go do something else to bring some money in for the family. Wow. And you don't see that much in this country.
No.
You know, they work real hard, and I think being part of the Economic Union of Europe will just propel them astronomically forward into doing things much more robust fashion, and using a lot of the skills that they can learn from the neighboring countries and from us, it'll be a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Now, as part of the training course, you're in a classroom situation. Was there an opportunity in this class, in this course, to actually take the students into a hospital, into an emergency room, into a trauma center, and show them, instead of using mannequins, actually work with patients who had been injured? Is that part of the course or not?
No, we mostly do it off-site from the hospital, so that they can have their complete and full attention. My experience in teaching courses in the hospital, as soon as they know that, you know, that you're down in the auditorium somewhere, somebody's going to come get you because the patient on the third floor needs you, or the family wants to talk to you, or this is happening. So we do it off-site to try and get everybody, and we try to encourage them not to turn their cell phone on until we go on break. We try to get their full attention by capturing them off-site.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do have some other colleagues, as I mentioned, who are teaching some other things, who are actually doing it in the hospital, but not this particular course.
Mm-hmm. Michael, from what you've observed in your 3 deployments, soon to be 4 deployments to Ukraine, what are lessons that you've learned if the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative were to come back to you and say, look, based on the terrific results that we've seen in Ukraine, we'd like to expand this program. How do you think this program could be improved, already from a very high level, could be improved and taken to other war zones or earthquake damaged areas or that kind of thing? What have you observed in this course that you think could take it to an even higher level and a more effective level?
Well, this interesting, as I mentioned, we have other courses that piggyback along with us and are taught to other providers while we're there. And one of those courses has to do with mass casualty response, which is very unique, not only to war zones, but to tsunamis and earthquakes and all those other things.
Mm-hmm.
is a course that is part of it. So each course is its own kind of unit, but there's a number of courses that can be packaged together and deployed depending on what you're trying to accomplish. Another big issue in these kinds of events is infectious disease and sanitation. You know, any place where you have refugees and you have destroyed infrastructure, you're going to have problems with food and water and shelter and disease. And so there's a lot of opportunities to teach a lot of different things. And then the last thing is, we're going to have a whole generation or two of people who are going to have post-traumatic stress, who are either going to be subject to the horrors of the war themselves or have lost a parent or a sibling or a child. I mean, this country has taken a terrible, terrible beating. And I think the mental health issues are going to be very big. And as part of the, you know, not only what we're doing now, but particularly during Reconstruction, mental health and getting tough guys to go for mental health assistance is going to be crucial. And I can tell you, that even in this country, it's very hard to get the men to go and talk to somebody about their issues. It's particularly if they wore a uniform and they always had that image of being a soldier or being whatever. It's the mental health piece is going to be huge.
Michael, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, can you share with our listeners your closing thoughts? How has this experience in Ukraine, how has that shaped your view of the world, of Ukraine, of your skill set, and how you've been able to, at this point, step into a war zone with the skills that you've acquired over 40 years as a surgeon? Share those closing thoughts with us, if you will.
This is something I think about all the time, because if I was 10 or 15 years younger, I would actually want to go and help by operating on patients on the battlefield. But the day where I can stand on my feet for 18 or 20 hours operating is probably past. But I was fortunate enough to find something that I could contribute in what I feel like is being able to give a service by using the intellectual skills of teaching that they were very receptive for. And so there's two parts to this that I think it's really important in your life, particularly as you get older, is you want to feel like you make some contribution, whether it's in national service or the military service or for charities or to your local library. I think the whole issue of being able to do service is very, very, very important and actually enriches people's lives around the world. The other thing is that I think it's very important for our country to be supporting Ukraine every way that we can. I think the fight in Ukraine is our fight. It's a huge national security issue. I think we need to give them every tool that we can, not only to fight the fight, but to recover from the fight. And I think it's extremely important. Like I said, I think it's a national security issue for the U.S. We can look at history. Now that I'm teaching history, easy example. Hitler got to take Czechoslovakia in 1938. Nobody said anything. He invaded Poland in 1939. Not much happened. 1940, he is on his way into France. If we don't stop, you know, Russia here in Ukraine and get Ukrainians back to their borders that the Russians actually signed a treaty agreeing to in 1994, mm-hmm. there's going to be trouble in the Baltics. There's going to be trouble in Moldova. There's going to be trouble in all the adjacent countries because it'll never stop. So history shows us we need to stop the Russians now and support Ukraine with everything we have. And it's actually, if the Russians do something involving Lithuania or Poland or one of those other countries, you know, they're NATO countries, mm-hmm. and we're going to be sending Americans to fight. Mm-hmm. I'd like to simply send our equipment for now and not have to send our young people to go fight. So those are two big issues for me. One is it's nice to be able to do some kind of service to your community or your country. Not beyond nice, it's really essential, and I think it's a great feeling of comfort to be able to contribute to whatever your level of skills is. And the other is, I think, on a national security basis, we have to support Ukraine.
And how can our listeners follow you? And in particular, how can they learn more about the Osher Lifelong Learning Program? Is there a website, an X handle, a LinkedIn connection that you can share with our listeners?
Yeah, there's a number of websites that are OLLI, Osher Lifelong Learning. You can Google OLLI, that'll get you to one. And a number of the universities around the area connected and have programs at their own university. So, you know, I started at Berkeley, but then went to Dominican and included now a couple other schools. So you simply Google OLLI, OLLI. As far as being on social media, not one of my strong points, particularly when all my kids are out of the house, no one's here to help me. The easiest way is for people to, I guess you could try on Facebook about once a month. I open my Facebook page and see if there's anything exciting. Otherwise, you know, they can inquire of you and get my email or something. I'm always open to answer questions.
Okay.
But I don't have much social media presence. I've never really had interest nor time, and I'm just not in the TikTok generation.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Michael Baker, first of all, thank you for your service and thank you for all that you do in Ukraine. And once again, thank you for joining us today and sharing your experience both in the military and most recently in Ukraine.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Mr. Herlihy. I noticed you've used a couple of my different titles, you know, Admiral and Doctor. But I have to tell you, it's the third title that's always been the most important. And that one's Dad. So, you know, I need to make sure I come home from this so that I could regain that third title and continue to provide that counsel and mentoring for my kids.
Absolutely. And for our listeners, today's episode is number 505. Listen to us on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms, wherever you listen to podcasts, and join our listening audience in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast, ranking us number 12. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.